This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This time around, it begins in Great Britain, but never mind that. The bicycling race getting underway today is the Tour de France. If it is not the World Series of cycling, it is at least the Kentucky Derby of the sport, the one event to which even people who don't know a bicycle from a basketball pay attention. Unhappily, for a decade now, some people have been paying attention to the Tour for all the wrong reasons, reasons like EPO, synthetic testosterone, steroids, and suspensions. On the 29th of June, we'll know the winner of the current race. We probably won't know the official winner of the 2006 Tour de France at that time. Floyd Landis finished first in that race, but shortly thereafter he was informed that a test measuring the ratio of testosterone to epitestosterone in his body had raised some alarms. Landis was fired by his racing team. For a year, he has been trying to prove that the testing procedure was at best flawed and perhaps completely incompetent and corrupt. His appeal was heard in May. In a new book, Positively False, Landis with Lauren Mooney argues that he won the Tour de France legitimately and has never broken the rules of his sport. Floyd Landis joins me now from NPR in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You charge in your book that Greg LeMond, the three-time Tour de France winner, is a liar, that Dick Pound, the head of the World Anti-Doping Agency, is a liar, and that the United States Anti-Doping Agency, which you characterize as, quote, corrupt, is not interested in finding the truth. Why are all these people out to get you?
Well, they're not all out to get me, specifically. I happen to be in the middle of a fight between the anti-doping agencies and the sport of cycling. They take advantage of cycling because of its publicity. Cycling is, for them, the best way to get their message out. And so they do anything they can to catch any cyclist that they can.
Arne Baker, working on your behalf, said that the document packet that the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency sent to you before the May hearing contained indications not only of, quote, mistakes, but of what would constitute malfeasance, his word, in medical practice. What was he referring to?
Well, originally we put these documents on the internet for everyone to see because, well, we have nothing to hide, and we wanted people to see how this lab conducts its testing. The lab in question here is in France. So when we put the documents on the internet and we pointed out some of the mistakes, they just went back and created a new original copy of the document package where the mistakes had been changed. I don't know that that would be acceptable anywhere else except with USADA.
Though appeals in cases such as yours are generally not open to the public, you insisted that your appeal should be open to the public. Why was that?
Well, because our concern, and still is a concern, was that the people making the decision, the arbitrators, could easily be manipulated by USADA and by WADA. They, first of all of the arbitrators from whom we can pick are pre-selected by USADA. So I had a concern that these people may have an agenda other than just trying to decide whether the test was done properly. So my only way of ensuring that the message got out, because probably otherwise people would just accept the ruling, was to let everyone see how the process worked.
In retrospect, do you think that insisting that the hearing should be open was a good idea?
Absolutely. I wouldn't change that for a minute. The only reason I think that people question whether it was a good idea or not was because of the Greg LeMond incident, but the fact is that's just one more piece of evidence that USADA is not defending science at all. Greg LeMond had no reason to be in that hearing.
Well, tell me what you mean when you say the Greg LeMond incident, because, of course, he had had something to say about your performance and other performances before this arbitration.
Sure, he has a long history of accusing everyone since he stopped winning the Tour. Accusing every tour champion of performance-enhancing drugs. Same thing with Lance and all the others. Before this, I had never spoken to LeMond. He commented in the press quite a few places that I was guilty and that, just like all the other tour winners, and that I should come clean. So I thought the honorable thing to do was to call him and tell him, look, if you have something to say, at least let me tell you my side of the story first, and then you're welcome to say whatever you want. In that phone conversation, he said that he had been molested as a child, and for probably half an hour he spoke to me about that, and frankly I was a little bit caught off guard. That certainly was not what I expected out of that phone call. Unfortunately, Mr. Gagan, former manager of mine, found it funny or decided to make a joke out of it. Now, I didn't know what to do at the time. He made a phone call to LeMond and suggested that his childhood problem was going to be made public the next day.
You concede that, and again I'm quoting, some people's belief in my integrity was shaken. You were in the room with Mr. Gagan when he made the call. How was it possible for this to happen?
Well, everything took place in a matter of seconds, and I wasn't sitting near him at the moment. This was a room where 30 or 40 people would come and have dinner. It was a bit of like a banquet room. Had I known it was going to take place, I most certainly would have done whatever I could to prevent it because, well, there was no good outcome by trying something like that. After it happened, it was too late. I had no choice. I couldn't call Greg LeMond and talk to him about it. The phone calls I had made to him had already been misconstrued. This was obviously offensive to LeMond, and I don't blame him for that in any way. But all this did the next day when LeMond came to testify was detract from the facts of the case and the science of the case. LeMond never testified about me admitting anything to him. And then furthermore, he refused to testify under cross-examination. He didn't answer any questions. So why he was there is beyond me. I believe it was just a stunt by USADA to try to change the subject. Throughout the whole entire hearing, the 10 days, they just kept pointing at the results, saying those are the results and that is a positive test. But their documents and the lab work didn't support it. They never measured testosterone. They measured something else and called it testosterone. And they never refuted that, and they couldn't refute it because it was documented in the paperwork. So rather than do the right thing and drop a case, they bring in Greg LeMond and another cyclist, Joe Papp. They brought them in to testify about things that are just irrelevant to a positive doping case.
You write of the appeal process that, quote, nobody, USADA, LeMond, Will Gagan, me, came out of it looking good. Do you feel that that was because a fair hearing was impossible from the outset or because your side botched its opportunity because of the phone call that you've mentioned?
No, it's because let me give you an idea why this kind of arbitration process can't handle a criminal prosecution, which is what this is. Had, for example, in the LeMond case, since we're talking about it, had we been able to have a deposition like you would have in any criminal case beforehand, the judge would know that LeMond is going to refuse to testify under cross-examination, and he wouldn't be brought in as a witness. He's a useless witness when he can sit there and impugn my character and then refuse to talk about himself under cross-examination. That also applies to any kind of document production by either side. The arbitrators can't force anybody to do anything. They have no power to hold anyone in contempt of court for any reason. And so this kind of thing, while it may be a quick and inexpensive way to deal with business disputes and things like that, it can't possibly work in a prosecution.
Floyd, given your charge that much of the testimony of the prosecution was for show, and again, this is what you wrote in the book, do you feel that the May 14th arbitration hearing can produce a fair result?
Well, the arbitrators are going to have to address the arguments, and there was many problems with those tests. I don't know how you could possibly convict me, but then on the other hand, we have been, throughout this process, provided some forged documents and I've seen some very questionable things go on. So I don't know what the outcome will be, but certainly anybody who was there and watched this case and understands the science of it, they know exactly what happened.
When one Googles Tour de France these days, about three-quarters of the stories have to do with doping rather than bicycle racing. Is this a fair representation of the state of pro cycling today?
No, it's not, and it's unfortunate for cycling because it's a beautiful sport to watch. It's fun to be part of. Anybody can pick up a bike at any age and ride it and improve for many years. Unfortunately, the subject has overwhelmed the positive impact that cycling can have for people. In my opinion, the only way the sport will ever succeed as a professional sport is for it to leave the Olympics. It doesn't gain anything from being part of the Olympics, and it only is forced to subject itself to WADA and USADA and these anti-doping agencies, which take advantage of its high-profile status to perpetuate their existence.
Floyd Landis won the 2006 Tour de France, and much of his life since then has been spent trying to prove that he did so legitimately. Positively False, which he wrote with Lauren Mooney, is published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Landis joined me from NPR Studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Richard DeBernardis, the organizer of the 109-mile El Tour de Tucson, has said that when his bicycle race is run in November, people are not going to be riding to be a Greg LeMond or a Lance. They'll ride without their heroes. Who can blame them? Among the winners of the last 11 editions of cycling's most famous race are Bjarne Riis, who confessed this week that he had doped, Jan Ulrich, whose former assistants have said they injected him with the illegal blood booster EPO, and Marco Pantani, who was kicked out of the Tour of Italy for an elevated red cell count a year after he won the Tour de France, and who died of a cocaine overdose in 2004. Lance Armstrong says he never cheated, but charges of doping have dogged him for years. Meanwhile, less than a week ago, Jorg Jaksha, who has ridden for five different elite teams since 1997, acknowledged that he had enlisted the services of Spanish physician Eufemiano Fuentes in a blood doping scheme. In the story he sold to the German magazine Der Spiegel, Jaksha implied that Fuentes, whom he characterizes as a master of disguises, had clients throughout the cycling world. The real surprise would have been if, having finished first in the 2006 Tour, Floyd Landis had not been flagged as a doper. So enough. We've thrilled to astonishing performances like the one Floyd Landis turned in during last year's Tour and then seen them called into question one too many times. We're all for fairness, and Floyd Landis deserves all available hearings, arbitrations, and appeals. But however his case is resolved, the public can't be blamed for writing off the highest level of professional cycling as, at best, out of control, and at worst, corrupt beyond measure, a ridiculous circus in which the authorities can't police their sport, and about 40% of the competitors claim to be suffering from asthma so that they can legally use medications meant for that condition. So as the 2007 Tour rolls out of Great Britain and throughout France over the next couple of weeks, more power to it. May it be fast, exciting, and clean, and somebody call us when the event produces a winner whom everybody can celebrate now and when the final test results are in. It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Bud Collins paints London Town red, and magenta, and puce, and plaid. But first, the annual budgets for cycling teams competing in the 2007 Tour de France range from $10 to $15 million. Prize money for this year's tour totals over $4 million. A round-trip ticket to France from the U.S. right now will cost cycling fans many hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. If you find the money associated with the Tour de France alarming, please listen to the story filed by Only a Game's Karen Given, who recently visited a bicycle race in New Hampshire where the stakes aren't quite as high. And the rocket red glare,
the bombs bursting in air. It begins, predictably, with the national anthem, early enough in the evening that the mosquitoes haven't started biting yet. Every Tuesday and Wednesday night in the summertime, the New England Velodrome hosts 40 to 50 cyclists who come to try their skills on the track.
The racing tonight is going to be fabulous. We've got some excellent, excellent competition coming up tonight.
Dick Ring is a bit of a legend in the cycling world. He raced nationally and internationally before becoming an announcer more than 40 years ago. He's retired now, but he volunteers his time twice a week, calling races and trying to entice more spectators and riders to come to Londonderry, New Hampshire for the Twilight Track Series.
Everything is close quarters, and you're going shoulder to shoulder with a rider. Plus, it's fun for a spectator because everything is unfolding right in front of your eyes. So we're in for an enjoyable evening, that's for sure. When are you going to get on a track bike?
Oh, wrong shoes today. What can I say?
How you doing? Back again.
Tony Eberhardt started these races 4 years ago on a track built for go-karts. The 14-degree bank isn't quite steep enough for bike racing, but Tony says the shallow incline makes the track more friendly for those just starting out.
We have bicycles for $2 for rent, so people come down, they can rent a bicycle, we'll give them instruction, we'll get them out on the track, and then 45 minutes later, we have them in a bike race. You come to the track, you're going to bike race. We can give you a try if you'd like.
Wrong shoes.
Oh, that's always a good one. I get that a lot.
The Twilight Track Series is a humble operation. Riders have to bring back their race numbers from week to week. And the rental bikes aren't pretty, but they allow those new to track to practice on a fixed-gear bike with no brakes. After all, Tony says, he's trying to build something from nothing.
We originally, in the first year, I think, had 8 people. And now we have over probably 300 different riders from all over the New England states that come out. Some of the best riders in New England come out. And we're slowly building interest here, and we've gotten some corporate interest. And hopefully we'll end up having enough money raised that we can build an indoor velodrome.
Tony has big plans for his track series. Not all the details are ready for publication, but he's raising money for that indoor velodrome. But when all the improvements are finished, will this series still have a place for everyday riders who want to see how they rank? At that question, Tony's smile lights up.
Yes, I'm just the average guy, basically. So this is basically a need for me to continue to want to bike race. Yeah, this is for the average person. That's what I like about it. You know, it's okay to have events where we can have professionals come in, and we want that. But I want it to be the average track where people can come and have a good time.
It looks like we don't have any more of that size.
Oh, do we have something comparable?
Lori Daly registers another new rider for the evening's races. With gate fee, cost of racing, and bike rental, the grand total comes to $15. The 45-minute lesson is free. Lori's seen more than a few new faces this evening, and experience tells her she'll see them all again soon.
Absolutely. When they leave here, you couldn't wipe the smile off their face. They will come back several times, and they'll bring friends. So, yes, year after year, they'll come back.
Mark Bowen uses a Post-it note to jot down the names and race numbers of tonight's new riders. He'll be taking them through the lesson, which is really more like an encouragement session. Track racing can be intimidating, Mark says, but it doesn't need to be scary.
Nobody has brakes, nobody has gears, and the bikes don't coast. So it sounds really crazy, and you're on a banked track, but in fact, nobody has brakes, so nobody's going to stop in front of you. There are no dogs, there are no cars. If something breaks, you're 318 meters away at the very most. So it's actually pretty safe.
Racers range from Julie Lockhart, a woman in her 60s who comes regularly, to a 12-year-old girl who showed up to race with the adult men. Even younger riders are being trained in a youth development league. But while everyone on the track is friendly, that doesn't mean they're not competitive.
Hey, 14 lap scratch race, guys. I'm going to start you off slow right here. Everybody can get clipped in, okay? Everybody get clipped in. Real easy here, real easy.
Like in NASCAR, the 20 or so riders start off slowly and get up to tempo before the race actually begins. Still, the first few laps are more about positioning than speed.
Jessica, go, 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 go! Oh. Jessica, go!
Some of the riders tonight are bicycle commuters from Boston who want to see how their skills stack up against trained racers. Others use the evening as a regular part of their schedule before big races. Eve McNeil isn't sure what kind of rider she is these days. She just graduated from Harvard, where she raced for the cycling team. She trained all season for the Collegiate Nationals and then crashed in the very last corner.
I was third going into it, and by the time I got up, 57 people had passed me. So I had to take a month off the bike and heal, and this is like I'm trying to get my mind back into racing and remember why it's fun.
So when she got back on the bike, she put on her Harvard jersey and drove up to New Hampshire, where she says fun is in abundant supply.
This is really the most fun that I've had on a bike.
Brian Belanger.
And it's a really different feel from road racing or mountain biking where you get to do just one race. You'll prepare for weeks for that one race, whereas you come out here and you'll do 3 or 4 races in a night. And you'll have some good ones and you'll have some bad ones, but you'll always go away having had a good time.
Races continue all evening, only pausing to line everyone up to start again. But if as many as a dozen races a night aren't enough, there's also the race within a race, called a preem. While the winner of the race itself will get nothing but bragging rights, tonight the leader of the race at its midpoint wins new handlebar tape. And every once in a while, someone jogs across the track and hands the starter, Aaron Nelson, $2.
Oh, here we go.
$2 for lap number 5.
All right, racing for a deuce.
The riders have spent the last 10 laps getting into the perfect position for the sprint to the end. But when Aaron strikes the bell, the preem changes everything.
Riders are looking at 4 to go.
I hear it. Preem, $2 preem, $2.
a deuce. $2. $2 preem.
The riders break into a sprint with all their might. Given the level of excitement, they might as well be racing for $2,000.
John Laufemaire, $2 richer. He's going to see his broker right after the race. He wants to invest this. Two laps to go. Everybody's back together. Ed Cross looking over his shoulder.
Ed Cross is known for competing in the 3,000-mile race across America. But he still gets a big smile on his face when he wins $2 in a 318-meter preem lap.
Well, that's it does help give me a cup of coffee on the way home. That is nice. It's a nice little pat on the back. It's the idea. You're trying to make the mid-race excitement. It's nothing to do with the prize. It's a matter of sparking it up a little bit. You know, monkey see, monkey do. Everybody goes, and then you have to rethink your strategy for the last couple of laps of the race.
Well, much of the cycling world will be focused on France this week, where sponsors will be paying millions of dollars for their logo to go screaming by on the back of a rider. And anti-doping officials will be knocking on doors in the middle of the night to conduct yet more drug tests. Ed Cross says riders in Londonderry will be having a much different experience.
I don't think anybody's going to be juicing around, if that's what you're talking about. I don't think anybody's going to be doing that around here. We're out here for fun. I mean, you know, if you win, even if you win every race of the night, what do you get? You get a pat on the back, which is fine. This is not meant to be a big media circus or anything. It never will be. I don't think it ever will be. But all I can say is when people come out here, there's nobody that walks away from here saying they were sorry they came up. Everybody just can't wait till next week.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Londonderry, New Hampshire.
Dane Nord, bib number 65.
Between showers in that portion of Great Britain most famous for tennis, the last American man departed Wimbledon yesterday afternoon. A U.S. woman could still prevail. Joining me now to look forward toward the conclusion of the tournament is Bud Collins, long a fixture at Wimbledon. Bud, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Roger Federer lost a set yesterday. What the heck is going on over there?
Well, you know, he didn't know where he was. He hadn't been around here since Friday. Through all this rain and through the benefit of a default from Tommy Haas, he did show up to practice once in a while, but he wasn't part of the tournament. And when he showed up, I sort of recognized him. I said, "You've been here before." Federer's the name. Yeah, that's it. I've got it now. But he lost that set to Juan Carlos Ferrero, who was number one in the world for a couple of minutes a few years ago. And he had to work hard, and he needed that work. He needed the competition. Now he's going to go for weeks. People have been saying, boy, that semifinal coming up, Andy Roddick of the United States and Roger Federer. Roddick is gone. Roddick is gone.
Roddick, of course, the aforementioned last U.S. male player, lost to Richard Gasquet in five sets. Does the Frenchman figure to go any further?
No, probably not. He played Federer in the first round here last year and didn't do much. But, Bill, this was Vive la France Day. They've never had a day like this since the 1920s for France, when the Four Musketeers were around and Suzanne Lenglen, because this Marion Bartoli, ranked number 19, what a long shot she is. She was 100-1 when the tournament started with the local bookmakers. And then you get Gasquet knocking off Roddick. They must be dancing on the Champs-Élysées.
Yeah, all that Ms. Bartoli did was knock off the number one seed.
Number one, yeah. You know what part of her inspiration was? You won't believe this. She looked up into the royal box and saw somebody named Pierce Brosnan, movie actor. Well, James Bond, and she was thrilled to death. She said it was a dream come true, playing on Wimbledon center court against the number one player in the world, and who's watching her but Pierce Brosnan. Wow.
What a shame that Justine Henin didn't see a movie star of her own on that
day.
Well,
somebody, guys sakes. She won the first set very easily and was ahead 4-3 in the second, and then for some reason. And this is the wonderful thing about sports. It wasn't giving it away or blowing it. This kid, Bartoli, just played marvelously. And she has two hands on both sides. She was coached and is coached by her father, who saw Monica Seles play once. And Monica Seles was using two hands on the backhand and the forehand. And this father of Bartoli, Dr. Bartoli, didn't know that was legal. And he asked a few questions because his daughter had a terrible forehand. And he said, we're going to put two hands on the forehand. You already have two hands on the backhand and see what happens. Well, she became a world-class player. But if you know her name, you're either a French sports writer or a real tennis junkie until today.
Also among the stalwart performers at the tournament has been Venus Williams. Is it too early to say that she has returned to the top of her game, Bud?
Well, she has returned to the top of her game. I don't think there's any doubt about that. She's playing better than she has since she last won this championship 2 years ago. And she's in a great frame of mind. She's got her boyfriend with her. And she was one of the few people who kind of enjoyed these rain delays. She says rain calms her, and it clarifies things. So she was talking like a philosopher a couple of days ago about the beauties of rain. Well, everybody else is going nuts and stir-crazy, and she's talking about the beauties of it all.
Rafael Nadal has a chance to become the first man to win the French Open and Wimbledon in the same year since Bjorn Borg did that 27 years ago. Is it a good chance, assuming that the tournament isn't suddenly switched to clay?
No, I think it's a very good chance, Bill. I picked him to win last year, and he got to the final and won a set. So I'm picking him again. I think he's improved his grass court game. He's strong. He's competitive. And Federer is definitely the favorite, and he ought to win, but I give Nadal a big chance.
My guest is tennis analyst Bud Collins. You're listening to Only a Game. Bud, this Wimbledon will go down in history for at least one record, the doubles match between Marcel Melo and André Sa on one side and Paul Hanley and Kevin Ouellette on the other. 5-7, 7-6, 4-6, 7-6, 28-26, 102 games. This may have been the only match in which everybody involved hoped that it would rain.
Yeah. I tell you, a man rolling around in his grave is Jimmy Van Allen, who invented the tiebreaker. And he would have said that was cruelty to everybody, a 28-26 set.
Bud, I understand that you will not be broadcasting for NBC from Wimbledon next summer. I'm sorry to hear that, of course, but I want to be among the many congratulating you on a spectacular run.
Well, thanks, Bill. I had 35 terrific years, and I have no complaints whatsoever. I'll still be writing for the Globe, and maybe I can get a paper route.
Well, I'm sure that you'll be quick to agree that radio is in all respects superior to television. Still, I would like to invite you to share with us some of your favorite televised Wimbledon moments.
Well, the top match, of course, was the 1980 final, John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg, when Borg won his fifth straight. The fourth set was an 18-16 tiebreaker in which McEnroe saved five match points. That would be the highlight. Also, a wonderful match, the 1970 Women's Championship, which went 11-9, 14-12, Margaret Court beating Billie Jean King, and they were both attacking, and it was a marvelous match, and watching Martina Navratilova on many occasions. She won nine titles, and I think a moment I liked was in 1978 when she was battling her rival and friend Chrissy Evert, and Evert was hitting a passing shot, and Navratilova, who was behind at the time, it hit her in the forehead. She was sculled. And that seemed to shake out the cobwebs, and she went on to win her first title.
Bud Collins, a.k.a. Mr. Tennis, writes for the Boston Globe and joins me from time to time to talk tennis on Only a Game. Thank you, Bud.
Thank you, William.
Don't wear white. Every day I work hard. And
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Style triumphs over substance in Los Angeles. Go figure. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Wednesday, the IOC awarded the 2014 Winter Olympics to Sochi. And Sochi is where, exactly?
It's on the Black Sea in Russia. And its name is so darling that for the first time, an Olympics is going to be able to name a mascot after
the town.
The town. Little
Fantastic.
Sochi, the bear, I guarantee it.
Perfect.
My favorite reaction came from the bid chief, Dmitry Chernchenko, who says that it was a historic decision for all countries. I'm sure in Tonga, they're like, yeah, we get to go to Sochi for the Winter Olympics.
Nobody's going to work
I was
there.
You know, all over Trinidad and Tobago. Yeah, man, we go to Black Sea.
The Tour de France is just now getting underway. Charlie, are you looking forward to 3 weeks of inspiring stories of superbly conditioned athletes battling adversity as they achieve their life's goals and dreams?
Yes, because as I always do this time of year, I've sat alone in a windowless room cramming for my biochemistry final, which will take place over the next 3 weeks.
NBA free agent Grant Hill will not retire. He'll play next year for the Phoenix Suns or not play. Which do you think it'll be?
I think he'll play some. This is a dive for the ring. Phoenix knows the window's closing. Grant Hill knows the window's closing on what should have been a better career than it was. If you need a reason to root for the Phoenix Suns next year, getting Grant Hill a ring is a worthwhile thing. I think he'll play a few games.
Talk to me of free agent acquisitions of various other basketball teams.
In a lot of ways, the most interesting personnel move, which sort of goes along with all the free agency, is that the Utah Jazz released Derek Fisher, who is taking time off to be with his daughter, who's severely ill, and was asked for and was granted his release from a three-year, $21 million contract to be home with his daughter, to which we all say good on him and best of luck.
The Seattle Supersonics picked up a new coach to go along with their revamped roster. Will all be A-OK with PJ?
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's been a while. He is alleged to be good with young players. He was so good with young players at his last stop that one of them tried to strangle
him. Tried to kill him, yes.
It's a big step for Seattle. It's sort of a risk. They have prize 1A from the draft in Kevin Durant. They're revamping their lineup. Rashard Lewis went to Orlando as a free agent. This is a big step for both PJ Carlesimo and the franchise.
Jeremy Roenick, late of the Phoenix Coyotes, announced his retirement this week, though in this case, announced is perhaps the wrong word.
Every now and then a hockey player reminds you about what modest people they are. He announced his retirement by sending a text message to the Philadelphia Inquirer that read, "I'm retiring. Is that still news?" Yes, Jeremy, you're a 9-time All-Star. It's still news.
Turning to a sport that people are actually playing at this time of year, how do you like the run the Colorado Rockies enjoyed against the New York Mets this week?
Well, this is terrific. This is one of those baseball things that I actually enjoy talking about. For the first time in more than a half century, a team went into New York and swept two New York teams, which obviously you couldn't do after the departure of the Dodgers and the Giants and prior to the beginning of interleague play.
Right.
But the Rockies went in and after swept the Yankees and swept the Mets, including beating them last time 17-7. The Mets are struggling a little bit. The Rockies had 20 hits. It really is a nice little bit of historic oddity.
One other necessity to that, besides the Dodgers and Giants being in the same place at the same time, you have to have the Yankees being really lousy.
That's right. That's another thing that wasn't common in baseball history.
Rain has delayed a lot of the tennis matches at Wimbledon. Charlie, I'm sure you're shocked. But anyway, that perhaps explains why some of the players there have had time to engage in various other activities, the production of a cookbook, for example.
Yes, love food, so that if all else fails, they said they can be a celebrity chef. Serena Williams apparently makes carrot cake. Maria Sharapova is a great fan of chocolate fondant, which I'm not sure what that is. Is that fondue with
Sochi.
More muscular ingredients? I have no idea. But yes, they are putting out a cookbook, and they all say it's a great way to relax. So good for them, because they've had a lot of time on their hands.
This week, Rodney Marsh, an Englishman who played for the Tampa Bay Rowdies in the days of the North American Soccer League during the 70s, said that David Beckham's life in the U.S., quote, would be hell. Hell, where exactly does hell come into that equation?
Apparently, Rodney Marsh believes hell is a road trip. He points out that when you play in the top-level Spanish league or in the Premier Cup in England, you don't have to travel very far, which is true. They're not very big places. But he is apparently telling him that hell is having to go from Tampa to New England or someplace.
That's awful.
I think Rodney's definition of hell could use some expansion, but that's just me.
How many $1 million makes this sort of hell endurable, I wonder? And speaking,
what fresh and well-munerated hell is this?
And speaking of English football, the NFL has folded its European League. Is this a result of the league clearing the way for real National Football League games to be played in Europe, or just lack of interest on the part of the locals?
You know, the last World Bowl drew 48,000. It's not an oddity anymore. If they really did this to soften up Europe for real American football, it's softened. Now, I had no idea, for example, that this thing had been going on for 16 years. That's astonishing to me.
When we last spoke, you expressed surprise that the America's Cup races were in progress. How surprised are you that the fabled sailing nation of Switzerland has emerged victorious in that competition?
Again, I don't even remember what the America's Cup looks like. As I recall, it looks something like a pitcher. But Alinghi had a photo finish over Team New Zealand. 1 second ahead to take the best of nine series 5-2. But, I mean, as far as I know, Dennis Connors finally got the zinc oxide off his nose, so maybe it's time for us to make another run at this thing.
And finally, Charlie, I leave to you the happy responsibility of welcoming lots and lots of new stations to the Only a Game family.
Yes, we have two new friends in Missouri, in Maryville and Chillicothe. We are all over Idaho, where I am proud to say we are broadcasting to the fans of the defending Tostitos Fiesta Bowl champion, Boise State, who gave us the most exciting bowl game in many years. And in Nevada, Bill, what have we done?
Well,
we've hit what?
We have hit the, wait for it.
Yes, sir. We've hit the jackpot.
Nevada.
Excellent, which is where you go when Laughlin isn't enough of a challenge.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. I'm a WKRP in Cincinnati.
A list of the most memorable rock and roll pseudonyms includes polystyrene, Captain Sensible, Epic Soundtracks, Poison Ivy, Cheetah Chrome, Klaus Fluoride, and He Who Cannot Be Named. Recently, Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder attended an event that featured competitors boasting great aliases and gripping ersatz rock guitar moves, and he has this real report.
It's a pleasant June evening on Los Angeles' Sunset Strip. But inside the Key Club's stuffy, cramped green room, it's a different story. The 16 contestants in tonight's air guitar competition are assembled for a brief pre-show rules school, and the heat is causing one of them to undergo a serious wardrobe malfunction.
You're having some spirit gum issues in your mustache.
Yeah.
Too much perspiration on your upper lip.
I was sniffing more than I was putting on my face.
That's expert Grindstein, the alter ego of a Fresno physical therapist named Tom. He fashioned his character as a kind of homage to industrial rock and Albert Einstein, replete with lab coat, nine-inch nails t-shirt, and that fake bushy mustache that just doesn't want to stay on his sweaty upper lip.
It's brutal, brutal. It's air guitarist with no air? How can this be? This is not good.
Tonight's competition is the last in a 14-city tour put on by U.S. Air Guitar, which, believe it or not, is the official Air Guitar Association of the United States. The organization was founded in 2003 by Kristen Rucker and Cedric Devitt after the two heard about the World Air Guitar Championships held each year in Finland.
Chris and I have always sort of been hugely into air guitar and absurd competitions and sort of fringe competitions and the like. And whilst we sort of were laughing about this World Air Guitar Championships, we realized that America had never entered it. And we sort of figured, well, that's absurd. How can you have a world anything and not have America be involved in it?
According to Devitt, an expat Irishman who once competed in the World Championships as Aer Lingus, the number of U.S. regional contests has doubled each year since the competition's inception. This year, the tour kicked off in early June at Washington's 930 Club and concludes tonight at the Key Club, L.A.'s heavy metal landmark. Each event, including next month's U.S. finals in New York, is emceed by Dan Crane, a.k.a. Bjorn to Rock, the Susan Lucci of air guitar, who has 5 second-place finishes to his credit.
It's a strangely addictive art form and a sport. I mean, it's a sport, you know. It's like you give a kid a football, and he goes out and he just won't put it down. It's kind of like you give a guy an air guitar. That was me, you know. I could not put my air guitar down. And you kind of keep getting close to winning, You know, you really just, you smell the victory, the air is in your bloodstream, and you can't stop.
Last year, Crane and his alter ego wrote a book about his experiences called To Air as Human, subtitled One Man's Quest to Become the World's Greatest Air Guitarist.
And it speaks to the idea of anyone giving up their job, sacrificing their girlfriend or their home life or all of the things that they're invested in to pursue a dream, no matter how ridiculous, absurd, or invisible that dream might be.
With the obligatory velvet rope keeping the 100 or so patrons in place outside, I take a few minutes to find out why people have come out to watch someone act like they're playing a guitar. Many tell me they've seen the recent documentary Air Guitar Nation. Some are here to root on their coworkers. Others, like these guys, are here to support their friends.
My best friend and I came all the way from Arizona to come watch him compete today.
You're out of here. Are you serious?
Yeah, 6.5 hours this morning.
Back inside, tonight's contestants, many of whom seem better suited for a Halloween party than an air guitar competition, are readying themselves for their 60-second performance, which, according to last year's U.S. champ, Hot Licks Houlihan, better be big if they want to rock the house.
You don't have the properties of a real guitar holding you down and limiting you. Like, your neck can be 3 feet long. Use the whole thing, you know. Use your tongue, use your face, everything. Just make it big so the people in the back can, like, feel what's going on, you know.
There's been no shortage of risky moves on the nationwide talent search. Some have paid off. Bjorn Turok remembers one for whom that wasn't the case.
A guy in Minneapolis jumped off a drum riser onto the stage and broke both of his legs. It's a dangerous sport, you know, and others have gotten whiplash. I know a guy a couple years ago shattered his ankles by jumping off a bar. People get crazy and they want to impress. You know, I know tonight someone's going to climb up on top of these monitors over here to my left, and they'll jump off of them. Maybe they'll do a stage dive from up there, and it's, you know, it's a risky business.
Not a good idea. For some contestants, however, the adage, no pain, no gain, might be just what the doctor ordered.
At age 43, I have a sciatic nerve that flares up. And I'm hoping that it does, because that would be conducive to the theme of...
That's George Hunter at Madness, a plumbing supply warehouse employee. He's sporting an 80s styles big hair wig and claims he was born for air guitar.
Oh, gosh, it's who I am. It is so who I am. I mean, if I'm feeling good, I might just break into it. It's a form of dance. It really is. You know, you're dancing with your hands and your head and your tongue and everything.
My name is Bjorn Turok. I will be your master of ceremonies this evening.
Bjorn Turok is on stage warming up the 500 or so patrons by tossing a couple dozen large red foam hands toward their outstretched arms. The foam hands are similar to the ones you see at college basketball games, but these are formed with index and pinky fingers raised into the sign of the devil. As Turok warms up the crowd, a panel of three judges sits in a bar booth come dais. Think beer-soaked American Idol. From there, the three will evaluate the air guitarists using a system modeled after Olympic figure skating. Scores range from 4.0 to 6.0, and the panel considers technical merit, performance, and, according to Bjorn Turok...
The last criteria is airness, okay? Airness is when your performance transcends the imitation of guitar playing and becomes an art form in and of itself. It's an incredible thing to see.
One by one, the performers flail around the stage as their song selections blare from the speakers. But with the exception of a couple unique performances, the crowd sees through the gimmicks. That is, until the hometown favorite and 2005 U.S. Air Guitar Champion, Fatim Huang, a.k.a. the Rockness Monster, takes the stage. Stoic, waifish, and sporting the shoulder-length hair of a rock star, the Rockness Monster is dressed simply. No silly get-ups here, save the dozen or so strips of Mylar fringe that dangle off his forearms. In a move reminiscent of Miles Davis, Rockness walks upstage, turns his back to the audience, and tunes his air guitar. His movements are slow and precise, not mime quality necessarily, but specific enough to draw the audience in. He raises his hand and points to the sound booth. The guitar riff is slow at the beginning, but in seconds it and the Rockness Monster take flight. Literally. Literally. Like a possessed Cirque du Soleil performer, Rocknest darts stage left up onto a stack of amplifier cabinets and, in mid-flight, spins around, diving headfirst into a roll that takes him back to center stage. As time runs out, the diminutive Angelino dives into the crowd, sealing his fate as everyone's favorite air guitarist. Despite a worthy challenge from the risky business-esque Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, it's the Rocknest Monster's night. He outperforms the other finalists in the second round, punctuating his compulsory interpretation of Quiet Riot's mental health with a final rush that sends him standing shoeless on random audience members' shoulders. Later, I met the Rocknest Monster, face to face.
I'm really competitive, so that coupled with my art background, I really look at this as art and trying to really elevate the art form. I put everything on the line, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, then I do it really badly, but the two times I've done it, the crowd's been there with me, so I've been pretty lucky.
After the winners are announced, the competitors take part in an ensemble finale. As Bjorn to Rock, tonight's contestants, and a couple dozen audience members air jam on stage to Lynyrd Skynyrd's Freebird, the Rocknest Monster moves away from the front of the stage in the glare of the lights. Every now and then, as a drunken reveler dips down to play a chord, I catch a glimpse of him stoically staring out into the crowd. Perhaps he's already thinking ahead of the finals in New York, or maybe he's just reading the sign that's fixed on the Vikie Club's balcony. The one that reads, "No stage diving." For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder on Los Angeles' Sunset Strip.
On August 16th, the Rocknest Monster will vie with 13 other regional winners at New York City's Irving Plaza for the U.S. Air Guitar National Finals. The U.S. champion will fly to Oulu, Finland in September to represent the United States against a dozen other countries in the 12th annual World Air Guitar Championship. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ben Singer and from Eddie Van Halen. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to check out Charlie Schroeder's Air Guitar Photo Gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from retired financial executive John Loppheimer, who glories in his New England Velodrome win, for which he received the staggering sum of $2.
Well, you know, you gotta shoot high in life. Never achieve anything if you don't really go for it.
Spoken like a retired financial executive. Retired. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.